Will Tris Speaker be the chosen pilot to lead Cleveland to a pennant this year? The handwriting on the wall indicates the Indians have a wonderful chance to cop. Wilkes-Barre, Sunday Independent, March 24th, 1920. Sign points all point to Cleveland pennant by Fred Turbyville. Cleveland's bid for its first American League pennant is being made with pep, harmony, confidence, natural ability, reserve strength. And Tris Speaker as manager is holding these elements into a baseball team that fans, experts, players, and managers all over the country look to see in the four when the 1920 curtain is rung down. To see them at work is really refreshing. Year after year, they've been bidding for the top-notch honors. Always there was a little piece of machinery out of gear. This year, owner Jim Dunn and Speaker appear to have assembled a machine that will speed through without a break. They've got reserve strength, enough extras and utility stars to make up a first-class team themselves. The regulars are all there as good, maybe better as last season. The 1919 weakness, a poorly conditioned pitching staff, and an absence of left-handers seems overcome already. There'll be plenty of good right-handers and a pair of southpaws who should go the route. Tris Speaker himself thinks they'll win. He doesn't think the team is affected by overconfidence. He doesn't believe he will be handicapped because of the fact that the Indians almost are the unanimous pick. He figures that will act as a psychological stimulus. Last year's infield, Johnston or Harris, Wambi, Chapman, and Gardner, and last year's outfield, Graney, Speaker, Smith, and Wood, are on the job. Caldwell, Bagby, Kovaleski, and Yule will make up the big four of the right-handers. Niehaus and Murchison will probably uphold the southpaw end of it. Elmer Myers or Guy Morton may be the fifth right-hander, and Joe Bowling is making a hard try for a job southpawing. Otto New reinforces Evans and Lunte in the infield utility ranks. Gilbert and Jameson will spell the regular outfielders. It is a team of class. The weather is good, and they're getting good workouts. The pitching prospects are unusually bright, and everywhere there is sunshine and smiles. Cleveland has its best chance at an American League pennant this season. If Indians don't turn in a win this time, there's no use trying.
Hi, hello everybody. Posman Josh here, coming to you from my basement in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. We got Posman Matt here, checking in.
Hello, Josh. Thanks for having.
Hey, good. Thanks. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear.
It's a big day. It's opening day.
Opening day, April 14th, 1920.
Opening day 1920. Yeah, it's not opening day 2020.
Unfortunately, sad face.
That is the sad truth. But we are ready for ball games in our 1920 season. So, if I'm correct, April 14th wasn't the first scheduled game.
No, is that right? Well, I mean, I think it was the first opening day of the major leagues, but. It looks like a number of teams had exhibition games, not necessarily spring training games, but both the Giants and the Dodgers were scheduled to play the day before the 13th against local amateur clubs. The Giants were going to play in the Polo Grounds against Yale varsity, Yale College, Yale University varsity team. And then the Dodgers were actually going to play out in Long Island against the New York Agricultural College. Unfortunately, both of those games were rained out. But I thought that was a fun little tradition. I wonder how long that lasted.
They do. Sometimes you'll hear about preseason MLB teams playing college teams, right? Like sometimes down in Florida, they'll play the big college teams. But yeah, that sounds really cool. That must have been a great experience for those guys. Well, it sucks that it got rained out.
Yeah, and I thought it was funny. The newspaper article called the Giants the McGrawmen.
McGrawman.
After John McGraw.
Well, and the Brooklyn team was the Robins because of their manager, Wilbur Robinson. I don't know if we covered that, but I learned that that's why Brooklyn was the Robins at that time.
Now, funny enough, they actually, I think, again, this is going back to last week's episode where we talked about how names were kind of interchangeable. In this article, this this journalist happens to call the Dodgers the Dodgers, the actual Dodgers. So, surprising. Yeah. This is New York Times.
Yeah, it goes back to the they had been the Dodgers for a period, for most of the time. And then Robins was kind of their nickname. And then at a point, yeah, they all started adopting official team names. This is funny. I mentioned this to you. So John Thorne, the official MLB historian, author of a bunch of books, was doing he had a Reddit thread in the Reddit baseball subreddit, an AMA, which means Ask Me Anything. So I asked him, I said, why did teams' names change all the time in the 20s and when did it stop? And he wrote back to me, which was like so exciting to me. He's like the official MLB historian chiming in for this week in 1920s baseball. Shout out to John Thorne.
John Thorne, thank you. And to other John Thorne, hello. What's up, buddy?
Yeah, Ross has a friend named John Thorne who's not the historian. I mean, he might be a historian. He's just not the 80-year-old John Thorne.
He's more of a foosball historian or foosball aficionado.
Oh, so. Yeah. That's important, though.
It's a very important game, yeah. So,
so he didn't exactly explain how and when. He confirmed that the official name on all the legal documents was just the New York American Club or the Boston American Baseball Club. That's what it was on all the legal documents. And then they basically started to realize that, yeah, it was like a branding opportunity and it was a fan base opportunity. And they started by putting they would sort of pick an official team name to put on the jersey. And then once the name stood up on the jerseys, and then it started showing up in more official documents. And it sounds like in the 20s was when it all, when this tradition ended.
Yeah.
Like teams' names got, there haven't been team names changing since. So right around this time is when it was still fluid. So,
and it sounds like, I think, when we, again, going back to last episode, it was different team to team. Some teams had already established that official name early, like the Washington Nationals in 1905, while others still had not yet.
And the Yankees were one of the first that made it really like their official, obviously their brand was a big deal. So that was incorporated fairly early.
I wonder when teams started selling uniforms, official uniforms, and stuff like, you know, merchandise. I wonder when that was. Baseball caps.
Yeah. I know that the team name didn't show up on the jersey until later. It was just the city name for a long time. So if you look back at the uniforms, it was a period of time until you saw the word Dodgers or Yankees or anything like that appear. So, but yeah, let's set the stage for opening day here. So we know that the Indians are a favorite. We read Tris Speaker's tea kettle takes that he himself thought that his team was going to be good.
Yeah. They finished in second place in 1919. And, I think, as you mentioned, before there was a couple other teams, right, that were looking pretty good in the American League.
Yeah, let's just first of all set the stage and remind everybody that there are no playoffs in 1920. There's two leagues. There's no divisions. It's just American League, National League, eight teams in each, correct?
Yeah. So when you talk about winning the pennant, it's getting first place in your league, whether it's the American League or the National League.
Yes, and the
and there's no interleague play. Play each other. So American League teams do not play National League teams, and vice versa. The only time that could happen would be, of course, the World Series,
which was very exciting. Obviously, yeah, the first time you get to see these guys face each other. The one thing, one of the reasons I think that changed is, like, if you were out of it early, you're out of it. Like, the Phillies were so bad. Like, and the Philadelphia A's were bad, too. The Phillies teams were both so bad. So if you were out of it, like, in May, like, you were out of it. Like, you had no chance of making the playoffs. You could be, like, 20 games back. You'd be in eighth place. There's just no way you're catching everybody. So there's no chance of playoff baseball for you. So that's kind of, like, a bummer for those teams, you know? It made the pennant race more exciting in one way, but it also – I don't know. Part of me likes it. Part of me likes – the addition of divisions and wild card games and stuff. I just like the chance, any meaningful game, you know, playoff game, it makes it all the more exciting. So when there was only seven or nine, as it were, in the World Series at that time, that was definitely so exciting to have everything focused down to a small, you know, relatively small series, whereas now we have round after round. But I get the appeal of extra playoff baseball. But anyway, in 1920, we had two leagues, eight teams, no playoffs. We had the 1919 series, losers being the most famous team of the Chicago White Sox because of – so here, starting 1920 season, it's not generally accepted yet that they threw the series in 19. There's a lot of theorizing. There's a lot of whispers. There's a lot of buzz. But it's not officially known. So, you know, the investigation is underway. But as far as the official story goes, the 1919 season was one where the White Sox surprisingly lost to the Reds. So the Reds were, I say surprisingly, because the White Sox team was so good. But for my first tea kettle take, I got to bring up the fact that the 1919 Reds were really good. I mean, they won the World Series, so that's not surprising. They're obviously forgotten about as a series champ, not just because it was 100 years ago, but because, you know, it turned out they didn't win that through no fault of their own. They didn't win. They didn't come by it fairly, but they were an incredibly good team. They were 96-44, which is a .686 winning percentage. They had a slugger named Heinie Groh. I'm not gonna make you guess. He led the team in home runs with five. So 1919 really was still dead ball era. Heinie Groh, but if you look at their slugging and, you know, a lot of extra base hits, just not home runs. They had a great pitching staff, the Reds did, with some great names. A guy named Hod Eller, a guy named Dutch Ruther, a guy named Slim Sally, and a guy named Ray Fisher. All of them had ERAs of 2.4 or lower. That's their starting lineup. League average ERA was in the threes, so the run scoring was hard to come by, but these pitchers were really good. Dutch Ruther had 19 wins and a 1.82 ERA. The 1919 Reds also had that dead ball style of stealing a lot of bases. They had five guys on their team who had double digits in steals. The fastest guy in the team, or the leading base stealer anyway, was also the best name, which with an amazing story I did not realize, but this guy was named Greasy Neal. So his first name's Greasy. His last name's Neal. Greasy Neal. Have you ever heard the name Greasy Neal, Matthew?
I don't think I have. If I have, it was, you know, in passing and it didn't stick. It should have sticked if it was heard before. I think it would have. Or maybe it wouldn't have stuck too much.
What's amazing about Greasy Neal is that after his baseball career, he became a football coach, including the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. So how about that? Greasy Neal was the Eagles head coach. I had no idea. Not that I studied football history all that much, but it was surprising to me to find this guy who I just thought had a funny name on the 1919 Reds, click his page, and it said he went on to be a highly acclaimed football coach, including the head coach for many years of the Eagles. So that's a great
Neal connection. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, speaking of local connections, this Reds team also had our man Jake Daubert, Shemokin's finest. If you remember Shemokin's finest Jake Daubert, if you remember the episode about the Chalmers Award, we talked about how in 1910, our man Chalmers started that award for the MVP. And we were talking about it because Gabby Kravitz was a runner-up in the to the Chalmers Award. And the winner, the year Gabby had his best year and came in second, was Jake Daubert, who now some years later was the sort of like fourth outfielder, I think, for the Reds. But he was a very familiar name to come across. So that's my tea kettle take on the Reds. I think they're going to be good this year, 1920. They were the World Series champs in 1919, so I'm not going out on a limb. But they got Greasy Neal, they got Jake Daubert, and they got a lot of pitchers. So that's my first take. 1919. Very good team was the team that won the World Series. That's why they pay me the big bucks for this insight.
Well, that's excellent analysis, Josh.
Thank you. Who do you like? Who do you like in 1920?
Well, I think you were trying to point me in the Indians direction earlier. So let me pick up where we left off. Sorry about that.
They're going to be good.
Yeah. So we have the article about Tris Speaker and the predictions. So I first off just kind of wanted they finished second in 1919. Right behind the White Sox. They finished 3.5 games behind. They were 84-55. So the American League actually, toward the top four teams, nobody won 90 games in 1919. So, as good as the White Sox are remembered in terms of their mythic status, in terms of the Black Sox, of course, they won in 1917, I believe, as well, the World Series. They weren't actually that dominant in 1919. So, you have the White Sox 80-52, the Indians 84-55, the Yankees 80-59, and the Tigers 80-60. And then there's a big drop off after there. But, if you look at those standings, you have kind of a really, even kind of split there, and really not a whole lot of space. So,
yeah, you could come in. You could come in fourth, and that in our modern mind, we think you're a pretty bad team. But you could come in fourth or fifth and be a really good team, just because of, well, it's an 8-team division or in the league, and also just you could be tightly bunched. Yeah, you could have a really good winning percentage and still come in fourth or fifth. So that's a good point. The White Sox.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't have a ton of information on the White Sox, other than that they. They were so good. The 1919 White Sox obviously have been covered extensively. Shoeless Joe was obviously incredible, but that pitching staff was incredible also. The Chicago White Sox team, I'm going to look it up real quick. I forget the name of the guy. I think that was Eddie Sicotti. Mm-hmm. If you remember from Eight Men Out, one of the pitchers who was so dominant. So I was just looking at his stats a little bit. So his stats in 1919, he was, if I'm saying it right, Eddie Sicotti was 29 wins and 7 losses, which we know isn't everything, but that's an amazing record. He had a 1.82 ERA, which even then was ridiculous. He had 30 complete games. Imagine having 30 complete games and an ERA of 1.8. So, and 29 wins. And then they had their lefty, who was named Lefty Williams, who had 23 wins. Pitching opposite Eddie. So that White Sox team, obviously Shoeless Joe was one of the most memorable players in baseball history and one of the greatest, but that pitching staff was nothing to be sneezed at.
Eddie Collins and quite another other great, great position players as well. So
they had some great nicknames too. Happy Felsch, Nemo Liebold, Buck Weaver, Swede Risberg, Chick Gandel. Those are all starters.
Fantastic.
The names are very good. Yeah, and then one of their reserve outfielders is named Shano, S-H-A-N-O. So, don't sleep on the White Sox. We don't know. They might be good in 1920. We don't know. It's not. Yeah. It's only opening day. They were certainly stacked.
All right. I was just going to finish up on the Indians here. Yes. I did a little bit more research kind of about Tris Speaker. So it turns out Tris Speaker was, in addition to being a famous, center fielder in Major League history and an incredible hitter, apparently he was actually a really fantastic manager and was almost the first manager to do platooning or actually to make it a regular thing. So it turns out he was the first manager in 1920 to do widespread use of platooning. He also was incredibly successful at cherry picking players that weren't highly scouted or weren't as well known from other teams or from the minor leagues. Like for instance, later in 1920, he's going to pick up Joe Sewell. We can talk about another episode, or we can talk about now, who I absolutely love, simply because, and he's in the Hall of Fame, because he's got the lowest strikeout rate in Major League history. And I wanted to see, Josh, if you could maybe guess how often Sewell struck out and maybe just one of his records. Yeah.
Just to compare to a modern player. Like, what's a, like, how do they, I don't even know what stat they go by. Like, they go by just... What
maybe
percentage?
Like strikeout per 9 innings, a strikeout per at bat. In this one, I have a strikeout per at bat, and then I also have the record for the most consecutive games without a strikeout. So
I really, Just going to think it out because it's not a stat I'm super up on. But, I mean, I obviously know that people strike out. Like, what's a big strikeout rate in the modern game? Like, you strike out one out of every three at-bats, maybe? Like, 30% is, like, a big strikeout guy
today? I'd say so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So like, one out of three, one out of four, right? That's at-bats. That's not plate appearances, correct? Right? That's actual recorded at-bats.
Yeah, probably would be plate appearances would be more sensible to track. Yeah. I'm sure that they do. But, yeah, I'm trying to think. Because guys strike out a couple hundred times a year in a 500, 600 AB season. So.
Yeah, let's say a guy gets 600 at-bats and he strikes out 150 times. That sounds like almost like an average today, right?
So that they strike out at 25% of the yeah. So back in his day, I don't know, maybe 5%?
That's a little high, believe it or not. Yeah? Yeah. So once every 62.5 at bats.
Wow. So that's like barely, that's not even 2%, right?
Nope.
That's
not 2%. Yeah. And he also has the most consecutive games without a strikeout, 115.
That's amazing.
So he had multiple years where he had single digit strikeout.
He had like, that's probably like 300-400 at bats in a row. That's unbelievable.
So, just to see.
And who is this again? This was Joe Sewell.
This is Joseph Wheeler Sewell.
And he's an outfielder on the Indians, is that?
He was an infielder. I think he was signed later in the year, but I just couldn't help but mention him.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on him. He sounds
He was a rookie later in the year, so.
I was looking too at – I wanted to do some hot kettle takes on some of the off-season moves. There weren't a lot. I mean, guys didn't – there wasn't a lot of trades or – I mean, we covered the Babe Ruth signing, but there weren't a lot of, like, moves. Like, if you look at any player – and this is not breaking news, but if you look at any player's profile page, you see the same team name listed a ton of times in a row. Guys went to Brooklyn, and they were in Brooklyn for 20 years. I didn't see too many, major offseason moves, but I did read some stuff about how hopes are high in Brooklyn coming into the 1920 season. The Dodgers were also, as we said, also known as the Robins. They were sort of middle of the pack in 1919, but they had some really good pitchers. They had a guy named Burley Grimes, that's a really good name. And you might have heard of him. He's pretty famous.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of him. Yep.
Burley Grimes. If I'm saying his name, Burley, I think. B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H. Burley Grimes. His nickname was Old Stubblebeard, which was a really good name.
As opposed to just Burley.
Which is already good. He's got two good names. Apparently, he wouldn't shave on days that he started. So they called him Stubblebeard or Old Stubblebeard. He didn't have a particularly great 1919, but – he is here at the start of really a phenomenal string of seasons that would be not that I know what happens in 1920 yet. Just I have a feeling he's going to be good this year, and he's going to have a big 20. The Dodgers hitter was probably – their best hitter was probably this guy named High Myers, which is – his name is just H-I, short for something, but they just always list him as High. So High Myers led the league in triples and slugging in 19 and total bases and RBIs. Which wasn't an official stat, but someone went back and did their best to figure it out. So, you know, in the dead ball era, if you lead the league in triples, slugging percentage, total bases, RBIs, you're a slugger. I mean, he didn't hit a lot of home runs, but Highmyers was a really good hitter. So we got Burley Grimes on the mound, Highmyers in the outfield. And then they also had a very good outfielder named Zach Wheat, who led the league in batting average a few years back. And he led the league in slugging 1 year. Mostly by, again, hitting lots of doubles and triples. But they had Zach Wheat, and then also his brother, Mac Wheat, was on the team. So I wanted to share that. They had Zach Wheat and Mac Wheat and Old Stubblebeard, High Myers, every one of them a good name, and every one of them looking pretty sharp coming into the 20 season. So I like the Dodgers, like the White Sox. I got one more if you want me to share one more hot take I got.
Sure.
It is that the Phillies are going to be bad.
Okay.
That is the coldest take of all.
Cactus Cravath is not putting together a good team.
He's over the hill. His best days are behind him in the what league was he in on the West Coast? Gabby's Pacific Coast League.
Cactus League. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think he was. I think they just what I read was he didn't like the nickname Cactus. People said he was prickly. He didn't like it. So he somehow preferred his nickname about killing a bird to the one about Cactus. Cactus, they're both cool nicknames, honestly. So who else we got? Who else are you looking at?
Well, I was going to quickly run down the Indians team, and then I was going to jump maybe to the Yankees. A couple of names you might know on the Indians opening day roster. Ray Chapman, we'll come back to him. He's our shortstop. Of course, we talked a lot about Chris Speaker. So he was – not only was he the manager, he was the third hitter in the lineup and their center fielder. Their slugger was Elmer Smith, a right fielder. And then another name that you probably recognize, Bill Wamingas, Wamsgans, another strange name. And then Kovaleski was their ace on the mound who started opening day, who actually pitched a shutout, 7 strikeouts, 5-hit shutout, an opening day against the Browns.
Nice.
So I will jump over to the Yankees here. I'm sure all of you big Yankees fans out there are excited to find out about what's going on with George Sherman Ruth and the New York Yankees. So I guess the first thing I wanted to mention was, looking at the preseason, was the Yankees were one of these teams that were starting to look to Florida for spring training. So actually in 1919, they moved to Jacksonville and set up shop down there. So they would move down there for a couple of weeks before the season, before kind of traditional spring training. Great an anecdote was, so they had signed Ruth. And apparently he had, quote unquote, had more success hitting golf balls than baseballs while he was down in Jacksonville. So probably going out on the golf course probably too often. getting
not surprised. Not surprised.
And wasn't doing so well. One of the exhibition games, a fan started heckling him from the bleachers. And apparently Ruth jumped into the stands. The fan brandished a knife, brought a knife out. But for some reason, thank goodness, decided to thought better of it and jumped back on the field. So that could have been quite a tragedy right before.
So the fan had a knife?
The fan had a knife, 1920, exhibition game. Almost, bring a knife to the game.
Almost stabbed the babe in preseason.
Yeah, if things had gone differently, who knows? So the Babe Ruth.
Classic Babe story.
Classic Babe story. Let me just give you a quick rundown of the 1919 Yankees.
Who else we got? Who else are we surrounding the big guy with? What are we? I don't know that I can.
They have their ace, Carl Mays, who I'm sure you've heard of before. They have Bob Schrocki, Ernie Shore, Lefty O'Doul. So they actually have some great pitching. They have their manager is Miller Huggins, which we've talked about before.
The Hugman.
Mm-hmm. They have the famous Wally Pipp at first base, which we all know is what, Josh? What is he famous for, Wally Pipp?
Oh, well, he was the man that Lou Gehrig replaced, right?
Yep. I think Pipp way back was, in a few Pipp years was. Later, but yeah.
Yeah. We don't have Gehrig quite up yet with the Babe, but yeah, we still got Pipp. Who wasn't a bad player, if I remember correctly. Pipp had some skills.
Yeah, let me. I'm sorry. I'm trying to find the opening day roster here. Also has lists. They list their salaries. You want to hear some of the New York Yankees salaries?
Yeah, probably not happy with what Babe was making because he was probably making more than.
So number one, at the very top, and again, this goes back to our Babe Ruth episode, our very first episode, where he was upset at Boston for his $10,000. A year salary. So he's up at 20,000. And then we have Bob Schrocki, the ace. All right, maybe he was the ace, not Carl Mays, at 8,000 a year. Roger Peckinbaugh at 6,500. Del Pratt at 6,500. Wally Pipp at 5,000. And then down. So, and then I actually see Bob Musil, famous Yankee, there at 3,200. So not a lot of money. Not a lot of money at all. So
even inflation adjusted, it's crazy. It's crazy to think how little they were making.
So opening day, the Yankees played the Athletics in Philadelphia, and they lost 3-1. And Babe Ruth actually made an error in right field, costing two runs to score in the eighth inning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he did not, and he, I think he went like 0 for 4 with a couple of strikeouts. So
he did not.
Not a good start to the game. Not a good start to his Yankees career.
And also the A's were really bad. So the A's are in first place. Way
to go. The A's the previous season lost 103 games, 102 games. So worst team in baseball the previous
season. You got to believe. So. That's great. Philadelphia had 200 lost teams. And that was when the season was shorter, too. So if you're going to lose 100 games in 1920, you're really bad.
It's two-thirds of the games. Yep.
And Philadelphia had two last-place teams because the Phillies were also really bad in the NL. Cool. And I know that there's another interesting name we haven't mentioned yet. On the managerial side in New York, which was the legendary manager John McGraw, a good player in his own right. And then now he's managing the Giants. And they were pretty good in 1919, right?
Yeah, I think they were in second or third place in 1919.
And so this was an NL team, right? Yeah, they were in the National League. They finished behind the Reds.
And if for those who don't know, they were probably the premier team. In not just New York, but probably in all of baseball at this time. Of course, they're the New York, a New York team, and New York being such a huge city, but also out of the three teams, they had the most success before this, as well as they played in the Polo Grounds in Harlem, in Manhattan. And I think at this time, the Yankees actually shared that stadium, right? So they were probably, like regarded as the number one ticket in New York City, more so than the Yankees or the Dodgers.
That's interesting. Yeah. And they had one of the great all-time nicknames, High Pockets Kelly.
Yeah. I saw that name and I'm glad that you mentioned it because I was going to forget.
I've seen his name before and I just don't get it. That is a great one. I believe that he's in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, High Pockets Kelly is in the Hall. His stats, I mean, he was in the league forever, from 1915 to 1932. He actually did change teams a bunch of times. He was with the Giants, and then the Pirates, and then the Giants again, and then the Reds, and then the Cubs, and then the Browns. So he had a long career with a bunch of teams. The bulk of his best years were with the New York Giants. And he was a good hitter. I'm looking at his player page in Baseball Reference. They talk about the bold numbers. That just means the year you led the league. So he's got some bold on his page. He led the league in RBIs some years. He actually he struck out 92 times in 1920, jumping ahead here to the end of the season, but that was a lot of whiffs for the time. He was like a slugger for the time, hit double digits in homers and struck out a lot. So. And those pockets, they were so high. They were like up to his ears. I'm going to have to look that up to see where that nickname came from because that is a funny one.
That is excellent. So, yeah, the Giants fared the same as the Yankees opening day, April 14th, 1920. They also lost. They were at home at the Polo Grounds. They lost to the Boston Braves. Again, the Braves, for those of you who don't know, used to be in Boston. And of course, they're in Atlanta now, but they did move twice. They moved to Milwaukee, I believe, in the 50s. And then
we didn't mention the Boston Braves at all. So, yeah, Boston had two teams. New York had three teams. Philly had two teams.
St. Louis had two teams, right?
Chicago had two teams.
Chicago, uh-huh. So, yeah, in terms of geography, we're still at the very, very kind of beginning of where these teams are going to be placed across America.
Yeah, we didn't really mention the St. Louis Cardinals or the St. Louis Browns, but yeah, those were the two St. Louis teams. Neither one really expected to do too much here coming into the 1920 season. More the Cardinals were more middle of the pack. If I remember correctly, the Browns were pretty bad. The Browns definitely had some years where they were just terrible. I guess they were kind of middle of the pack expect coming into this season too. So, So, yeah, we'll keep our eye out on our lowly Philly teams as well as see how the Indians do. We'll see how the Yankees with Babe do. We'll see how High Pockets and his team does. We'll see how the Reds, Robbins, and Shrewsbury Joe and his White Sox too coming in here to the 20 season. So, yeah, I'm excited. I think next time we talk, we'll give you a really like a full rundown of all the opening day highlights coming and going.
And we'll talk about some of the nuances and the things that are different. You know, hopefully, like game time. I think the Yankees game against the Athletics was like about an hour and 40 minutes. So just to give you an idea.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm always a little bit defensive when people complain about how slow the game is because I just like baseball. So I'm like, who cares if it goes long? But when you watch an older game, there is something to be said to the pace of play around 2 hours. Like it really moves. I was doing a little bit of research on for my writing for Sabre about the 1983 series because there's a thing in Sabre where you don't have to have attended the game, but they're trying to do like a Sabre historian write up of every game in Major League history. So if you want to get involved in Sabre, I mean, there are a lot of games yet to be claimed. I mean, there's so many games, it's ridiculous. So I thought I would do the 1983 World Series because I was there for the last game, the game the Phillies lost to the Orioles. I was like 7 years old. So yeah, it wasn't a great year for a Phillies fan, but I have lots of memories of it from being even that 7 years old. I remember sitting there.
Yeah, and those were two really good teams. If I know my baseball history,
I mean,
that Orioles team was a phenomenal team. And the Phillies were really good as well.
The Phillies were like, that was the year that they were
Pete Rose, right?
Yeah, they called them the Wiz Kids because they you know, the old Phillies was the Wiz Kids when they were young. They called this team of era Phillies the Wiz Kids because they had a lot of guys a little bit past their prime. Rose, Tony Perez, Steve Carlton was not past his prime, but I'm trying to think who else they had that was older. That team also had Gary Maddox and Gary Matthews and Larry Boa. Well, you know, a lot of great Phillies. But their big offseason signings were guys like Tony Perez and Pete Rose. They did have like one of the oldest average ages of the team. So, but anyway, that game is on YouTube. So it was really fun to go back and watch. And just even the pace of play from the 80s, you know, is so fast. It's just like from just so few pitching changes. Batters don't wear a lot of gear. Like, you know, protective gear. Yeah. So when you get on base, then they just are pitching to the next guy. Like now,
and everybody, they see their pitch, they hit it, kind of thing. They swing at it. Yeah, they don't try to work the count as much.
But yeah. Also, that Orioles team did have phenomenal pitching. So it was really Jim Palmer was like, he didn't even start. Like he was like their fifth starter. Like he was past his prime, but still, that was Jim Palmer. And they had four guys better than him. So. Anyway, it was super fun to watch. I do think the ideal length for a baseball game is 2 hours. I do, like, I will go on record with that statement. despite my defensiveness when people complain about
basically. I can wholeheartedly agree. So
that, yeah, that's neat. And I know that there were some rule changes that were happening here in 1922, so we'll get into that next time as well.
Okay. That sounds great.
All right. So thank you, Matt. Thank you, listeners. We're off and running. The season's upon us. Play ball.
Thank you, Josh. Yeah. We'll see you next time.
All right. See you next time on This Week in 1920s Baseball.
Later.